With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight. It's time for the publisher fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new Ingram power.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood, I'm the Editor-in-Chief at Video Week, and this week's guest is Lauren Wetzel. Lauren is Chief Operating Officer, COO, at InfoSum. If you aren't familiar with InfoSum, they are one of the companies who've been at the forefront of the industry's moves towards privacy. And they're probably best known for their clean room technology, which essentially enables you to connect two different data sets anonymously and in a privacy-compliant way. But the company has a bigger vision for clean rooms beyond just media and advertising, which is something that we discuss in our conversation. Lauren has established herself as a well-recognized industry leader. She spent time working with Deloitte, AT&T, and Xandr. And we discuss everything from Lauren's career to why she really hates the term clean rooms. Just a bit of housekeeping from us. We have New Video Frontiers coming up on April 28th, which will be in person. And in London. It's going to be our biggest and best event ever. We'll be expanding the conference into an additional additional stage, the innovation stage, which we're excited about. We'll be announcing the full agenda soon, but I can let you know now that one of the first speakers we're announcing is the wonderful and inimitable Rory Sutherland. Rory is Vice Chairman at Ogilvy, and I think if you've seen Rory speak before, you know that that session is one that you really shouldn't miss. If you haven't seen Rory speak before, you're really in for a treat. So you should get along to New Video Frontiers on April 28th. Tickets for that one are available at newvideofrontiers.com. Okay, so now I'll cross over to my conversation with Lauren, and I hope you enjoy. So, Lauren, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Vincent. Thanks for having me.
No, delighted to have you here. So, firstly, okay, question I sort of tend to ask most people is, how did you come to be in ad tech? I think most of us have sort of fallen sideways into this industry. And, you know, how did you come to be in your current role at InfoSum?
Well, I've been at InfoSum for over a year now, but, you know, the lead up to that actually is that I've been closely connected to the company since they first started to evangelize the tech in the US. So it was really 2019. I joined the team in 2020, but in 2019, I really got to know the team very well. And that was by way of being a part of AT&T just prior to InfoSum. And so at AT&T, I held a number of roles within their advertising division, a company known as Xandr, which at the time was both media division representing addressable television advertising as part of DirecTV assets, and then also ad tech, which was a huge undertaking by AT&T at the time as part of their journey to become a modern media company. Xandr acquired two ad tech companies, notably AppNexus and also Clipped. And I was really one of InfoSum's first customers as a part of Xandr. And in my role as strategy and corporate development lead, I helped to lead an investment in InfoSum while they were fundraising for Series A. So it was a unique story and obviously also a helpful position to know the team and the tech as a customer and also as an investor prior to joining full time. And it obviously made the leap from a much larger organization, regulated company like AT&T into a much smaller one, but fast growing like InfoSum much easier. At the time. And so prior to AT&T, I worked across major tech and media companies. So from walled gardens to traditional broadcasters. And from this seat was doing so as a management consultant. So I was with Deloitte in their strategy practice and really focused within tech, media, and telecommunications. I also had some stints at Freewheel. And my very, very first job actually within advertising is a bit of a throwback to Avenue A Razorfish. Which does still exist today, but at the time is owned by Microsoft. So a little bit of a journey. Consistent threads are on the intersection of media tech and data. And, you know, I think right now it's like the perfect time with, you know, my role as really playing a strategist and a lot of those you know, experiences, which is data collaboration and the work that we're doing at InfoSum, I think is, you know, going to help pave the way for the next 5 years for the industry.
I think, yeah, just what you said about joining InfoSum after, you know, sort of being exposed to their tech as a client, it resonated a bit. One of your colleagues, Stu Coleman, I can remember having a coffee with him in King's Cross, and he just joined. And when he was explaining the concept of clean rooms, I mean, it's easy to take them for granted now that, you know, we all understand what they do and what the function is. But I think when you first encounter it or heard about it at a time when we're all looking for a privacy compliant solution, there's sort of a light bulb moment for a lot of people. And I don't think I blame anyone for jumping ship and getting involved. So, I mean, before we start speaking about clean rooms, I think, you know, we can't assume that everybody will understand what a clean room is. So it would be helpful if you, just give a bit of an overview of how the tech works.
Yeah, absolutely. I always like starting a little bit with the why. So I guess the tee up in something you know well, which we've seen over the past decades, not even decade, but decades, is really the proliferation of data. And with that data, the more data becomes accessible, the need for greater protection and security when you're collaborating. And that is a new requirement as consumer trust and privacy is paramount for organizations. And unfortunately for, you know, ad tech, as you mentioned, this can often run counterintuitive to many of the practices and processes that underpinned ad tech, which relied heavily on sharing and commingling sensitive consumer data. And so clean rooms have really just emerged. That's really the why. They are looking to solve these major challenges about data collaboration. And really the easiest way to explain it, a data clean room is a secure environment where multiple data sources are matched and analyzed, and you're doing so without sharing or compromising the data itself. And so you often see it positioned as the best of both worlds, where you get the safety and security of data combined with the power and intelligence of multi-party computation. But it's also not a new concept. So Google actually was the first to launch their data clean room, I believe it was 2017. Don't formally quote me on that, but Ads Data Hub, I think it was around 2017. And then it was fast followers by Facebook and Amazon. And really, it's safe to say that any large enterprise organization that values its customers and customer data is really starting to put some walls up around proprietary assets. But we also see more customer-centric companies adopting this and launching their own solutions and market as well. But I really think it's important to understand that even though, you know, there's this notion of, you know, the clean room sector, that not all data clean rooms are created equal and often don't solve for the same needs. And even some fail to provide some of the basic requirements such as enhanced privacy protection and complete non-movement of data, which obviously we'll get into today.
So I think it's fair to say that clean rooms have gained a lot of traction, certainly, as one of the privacy compliant solutions for the industry, I think, particularly in TV. But to what extent are they actually working? I mean, that's the question that we're asking at Video Week mostly this year, is we're trying to get away from the, here are the range of solutions and these this is the future, and trying to actually get under the hood a bit and seeing, you know, what actual performance are they delivering for advertisers, and you know, is it comparable to where we're coming from with cookies? So how are they actually working in practice?
Well, I think in contrast to cookies, it's a little challenging because it's apples to oranges, but I definitely see incredible performance across different dimensions. And it really just depends on the objectives of the brand. And so whether it's reach or specific sales conversions, we have some great case studies on, you know, incremental lift. So looking at direct incrementality measurement between a brand and a media owner. And while privacy, you know, often data clean room, you know, to what you just said, it's about the solution, it's about privacy, and it's about, you know, some element of innovation. And that's absolutely one of the key reasons for the growing movement behind the tech. It's just so much more than that. And, you know, for any client who's adopting new technology, they're looking for a return on investment and therefore looking at performance. And so, you know, time again, across multiple continents and different markets, we've seen success stories from clients at agencies and brands who have used InfoSum's clean rooms across different use cases. And so one of the advantages for clients like Omnicom is a really great example. And we've been pretty public about our partnership. They actually recently were just talking about this in a feature with one of their great clients, Clorox, where Clorox has recently seen, has been indicating where brands target audiences indexing. And so changing around media buys on certain channels, if they identify that one of their key audiences is over-indexing for an interest in a specific topic, and the speed with which these platforms can be utilized are really helping clients to identify if media plans are working as intended, and then allowing them to quickly shuffle around budgets, meet product awareness needs, as well as obviously figure out and discover the best audiences and the best publishers to work with to reach those targets. And so I think what you'll see from us a lot more this year is really getting to that performance and starting to talk about data clean rooms in, you know, much more solution oriented and sort of use case driven way. And I think that's sort of like chapter two of the clean room anthology that the market really needs.
And you know, does this only work, do they only work for advertisers that have, you know, significant amounts of first party data, or, you know, is there, has there been sort of successful use cases where, you know, maybe a slightly younger company or maybe a, you know, a CPG company that maybe doesn't have quite so much first party data? If you're, you know, I would question, you know, how much Colgate how much first party data they have on me.
In spite you haven't gone to Colgate.com anytime recently. I always, whenever I explain that not everyone has the same data assets, I typically ask, you know, especially if it's just talking to family and friends, I always ask, okay, what's your favorite snack? And then someone will say, okay, my favorite snack is this, you know, XYZ granola bar. And then I'm like, okay, well, how often do you visit that XYZ granola bar? Do you have an app for that granola bar? What are you doing? And obviously, you know, especially CPG, the industry is trying to move in that direction for more first party data strategies and collection of data and loyalty programs, et cetera. But CPGs is a great example of, you know, may not have that same data, but really heavily reliant on data collaboration platforms and clean room environments to enrich their data. So it's not just about the companies. I think for InfoSum, our sort of initial client base were companies who were just ready, you know, ready with a lot of first party data, ready to launch new products. But we absolutely have smaller brands and smaller publishers, and, you know, and not just being about first party data, being about enrichment across second party, third party, it being about, you know, creating co-ops and partnerships, and finding ways to kind of extend and drive incrementality across audiences. And so that could be a partnership and collaboration within a clean room with an ID vendor. That could be in building cohorts. And so I think people always think clean rooms and they think first party data, and they always think clean rooms and they think that you have to have all of your first party data, you know, and that's the only way your clean room can be successful. Actually, I think the opposite. I think, you know, it's really about leveling the playing field and, you know, bringing together partners when you don't have that access to that first party data.
And I suppose that the clean room functionality, or, you know, the fact that the data isn't transferred anywhere makes that those cooperatives probably a little bit easier to manage, as opposed to, you know,
totally zero trust environment. You don't even have to trust that your party, that your partner has the same standards as you when you're not sharing that data and exposing it. And I think that's a huge difference. And why not every clean room's created equal. And definitely, you know, trust is a business challenge. And trust is, you know, there's many advertisers and brands who have trusted major platforms who have then gone under siege, you know, more publicly with data security issues and privacy issues, which I think has really helped to drive awareness of these trends and then therefore adoption of innovative technologies like clean room technology. And I think that's really, really important. The notion that you actually don't have to even trust the partner because you can know that your data is not being shared.
So yeah, and that sharing is, to what extent are we seeing that on the sell side as well? Are we seeing, you know, where typically, you know, a publisher or broadcaster, you know, are they able to sort of overcome their sense of competition, you know, when it comes to sharing their data with competitors? You know, I'm thinking there's always an incentive for the most dominant player for in a market, for example, to maybe protect their data a little bit more than some of the smaller competitors, or are they open to sort of cooperating with one another?
Absolutely. I see a lot of publishers building new businesses where they were solely relying on selling by context and not providing a lot of options. I think, you know, to your first question on like, is this working for publishers? I think some publishers are launching just new products and creating new revenue streams utilizing data cleanroom technology. So I think that's one. And as it relates to the data sharing cooperatives, I've seen a few different trends here. I think in the UK and Germany and Belgium, we've definitely seen a lot of publishers, for a lot of reasoning, to your point, combating the walled gardens in discussions and with some announcements coming soon on, you know, fully adopting co-ops, and we're helping to remove that friction by way of being able to kind of trust across those partnerships really easily and also be able to work really securely and quickly. And I think that's a huge hurdle for some of the small players as well, is just the ability to work quickly and to be able to kind of be in those environments and stand up those networks. In the US, we're also seeing a lot of TV companies coming together to tackle common challenges around addressable TV advertising and even more complex topics like new measurement standards. And so I think we also see cooperatives in the lens of, you know, how clean room technology can play a role in those partnerships and even new products or new currency standards as well. And so I think it's a common trend. And I think the decisions that are coming from some of the larger platforms are going to continue to drive the urgency and need for cooperatives to be stood up.
And is it possible for an advertiser to, you know, target across a range of public publishers, you know, in real time, you know, as they would have with cookies, not necessarily on TV, of course, but, you know, to be able to deduplicate their reach across, you know, a range of publishers, you know, or are buys typically more of a direct, you know, I'm matching my data set with broadcaster X's data set, and, you know, the data matching is done and then we make the buy? Or, yeah, how does it work? Is it possible to buy across that range of publishers and deduplicate, and how real time is it?
Yeah, advertisers can absolutely activate audiences across an open exchange using our integrations that we've had with DMPs and SSPs and DSPs. And that's all just based on their specific supply chain workflow. But to your question on in real time and you know, similar to cookies, like the answer is yes. It's been a key strategic initiative, frankly, for InfoSem to just make it as easy as possible to be integrated across the broader ad tech ecosystem. And so we have some clients who still focus, to your point, on direct buys and are going to continue to build higher walls. But we also see the need where certain publishers just don't have the reach to meet an advertiser's campaign demand, and where we see buying across pubs as a critical requirement. And so, you know, we're sort of built today and in market today supporting both.
That's interesting, because I think there has been a narrative that, you know, the sort of long tail publishers might die away, particularly, you know, there's lots of, you know, high quality long tail publishers, of course, who, you know, are very deserving of advertising money, but there's probably some less scrupulous publishers out there as well who have all sorts of sort of cheap and nasty slideshows that they want to monetize. So you know, do you think that open ad exchange ecosystem is going to continue in the way that it has done up until today, is it likely to die off as we become more privacy compliant?
I wouldn't say it would die off. I would say it's going to continue to be challenged. And I really think that you know, to your point on shady slideshows and, you know, and certain publishers who have kind of already become under siege. I just think that this growing awareness from consumers and, you know, the value of an audience is still based on you have something that's out there that people are reading and, you know, and subscribing to and joining and, you know, adopting in terms of a range of strategies. And so I think a lot of this is going to come to some of the intermediaries and some of the larger, you know, ad technology leaders to kind of adopt this privacy compliant and privacy enhancing technology. And so that they can really help things like the open exchange, to your point.
So I rather stupidly was sort of leaving it the fact that they would have to have your first party data to begin with in order to make the match. So I suppose, yeah, low quality publishers who don't have any subscriber information are likely to struggle in this sense, I suppose. That's right, yeah.
Yep.
Okay. I have heard that, you know, some people are saying the initial setup, I think with anything new when it comes to ad tech, the initial setup was quite cumbersome and difficult. And I think it's partly just people doing something new. But is that still the case today? You know, again, that was people sort of talking with some of the clean rooms in the early days. And is it something, or, you know, is there just a certain amount of pain that the industry needs to go through in order to get everything set up?
So what I've seen with our clients, those who are ready to embrace clean room technology, they know what data they have available, they're ready to set up, they know the partners, the setup, in my opinion, isn't cumbersome. At least that's not what I've seen. I think traditional technology solutions for data collaboration have been more cumbersome to implement just due to InfoSec contractual contract approval. And so I think the broad lens of data connectivity or data collaboration, you know, oftentimes you're still talking about centralizing the data, which is obviously different to how we do it at InfoSum. And so with those solutions that rely on data sharing, you know, often it can become more cumbersome. When you remove the need to share the data, that comes down dramatically in terms of timing and speed to market. And that's something we pride ourselves on, which is speed to market. We can execute InfoSec privacy and contracting approvals in less than a week. And it's just allowing the organizations that we work with to stand up their investments faster. I also would say data matching is instantaneous within the platform compared to the days with other providers where you're just waiting, you know, often 7 days to 3 weeks to get a match back. The last thing I would say, most traditional clean rooms are built for data scientists and not for marketers. And so one thing I think is really important, and I typically will display this with prospects or clients, which is, you know, the ability for our solution to be really flexible for all user types. So you can get up and running really fast, no matter how much you've invested in data scientists rather than your business analyst, who can also use the platform. I always joke, if I can do it, anyone can do it. But I think to your point, you know, adoption and innovation is always challenging. And maybe it's just that not every company is on the exact same timeline in terms of, you know, it's the year 2022 and I'm going to adopt my clean room in January. Well, I'm going to adopt my clean room in February. I'm going to adopt my clean room in March. And so I think the goal for all of this is to build a new sustainable and privacy first marketing ecosystem, and that we should just acknowledge is in a small undertaking. And that's, I think, what will take more time, and that consistent adoption, because there's just going to be first movers, which we've seen loudly and proudly in headlines talking about data clean rooms. And we also have a lot of laggards who adopt this ecosystem, you know, later. And hopefully, if we don't see some repeat history of the publishing industry, hopefully not too late.
Yep. You mentioned to me before about how you don't particularly like the term clean room. Which is something I can relate to. I think as we're going through a pandemic, it's something that conjures up images of, I don't know, people in hazmat suits spraying down ad servers. But
you're lucky this is a podcast and you just don't see what I'm wearing behind you.
You also said the term's a little bit reductive, I think. I think you feel that, you know, that there's clean rooms have capabilities that can deliver a lot more for people beyond data matching. Could you explain a little bit more about that? How the InfoSum roadmap might sort of expand beyond this thing of, you know, matching an advertiser's user with a publisher's user.
Yeah, absolutely. The feelings on the terminology clean room, that was pretty spot on. I feel like when we're talking about new innovations and the evolution in computer science and edge processing, virtualization, cloud adoption, I just don't link those exciting advancements with hazmat suits in a tiny little room, you know, back in 1960 or whatever the advent of the word and terminology came to be. I also just think it can be misleading. As an industry, we're often intellectually lazy, frankly, in terms of how and when we label certain technologies. And it gets dangerous when it comes to the technologies that are different. And so I said this earlier, but not all clean rooms are created equal in terms of both the underlying technology and then also in terms of the use cases enabled. And so when you asked on data matching use cases, that's of course a critical use case for data clean rooms and for InfoSum technology, but data matching doesn't just have to be direct. It can also be cohort building. Data matching often implies two parties. Many data clean rooms can only support, you know, two parties in the environment and can't handle multi-party collaboration, but that's something that we can handle. It's a huge differentiation for us, why a lot of our clients have adopted us, because that's how you can really take advantage of not just a data clean room, but really a collaborative data network, which is a term I often use when I talk about it. I mean, any client who wants to call it a clean room and we'll wave that flag. I think we'll call our subdivisions of the industry what we'll call them. But I really think collaborative data network, which is all about safely connecting multiple data clean rooms to create an aggregated network of customer intelligence. I just think that's such a different concept. So you're thinking about, and you mentioned this earlier, a brand who may have collaboration across their own CRMs internally, a few demographic, say, in enrichment partners, and then also a partnership with a retailer to understand transactions. And then all of that exists for the brand in their environment. And then they want to partner with a media owner where the media owner may also be connecting various databases within its own walls, has different products, as well as cooperative partnerships, enrichment vendors, maybe an ID graph for additional reach. And so I think those are examples where it's not just about matching, it's also about enrichment. And, you know, I think to the point on, you know, data clean rooms not utilizing the same technology, like we talked already about this, but the zero trust data sharing, we're the only clean room that offers self-service, multi-party collaboration and computation, which again, that's the holy grail of what we need to drive effective campaigns. But with absolutely zero data sharing, which is what helps your privacy and compliance teams sleep better at night. And there's a lot of elements of the technology that's different in that instance versus centralizing data, exposing data, sharing data, even within clean room environments. So I think those points are really, really important. I think the industry can always do better in how it labels things, and there's investment banks to blame and trade bodies sometimes. But I do think the industry is leaning into clean rooms. I think it's a term that's here to stay. And I think it's just our job to continue to educate on the nuances of the tech and use things like case studies and performance to help, you know, explain the differences and the nuances.
So privacy campaigners listening to that might be, they often have quite a pessimistic take on what the industry gets up to, as is probably their job. But they might be concerned around, you know, these some of the language around, you know, connecting data, different data sources all over the place. I mean, yeah, there seems to be, I mean, to be honest, we're getting to a point now with some privacy campaigners where you're kind of wondering, is this just, you know, you're just anti-targeted advertising? You know, you don't feel that an ad should ever be shown to an appropriate person under any circumstances. But, you know, is there anything about, you know, this that could concern the privacy campaigners? And perhaps might they, you know, as they often do, shift the goalposts, could they be shifted in a way that, you know, doesn't favor this data sharing model? Or, do, you know, is the privacy case for this, and, you know, the clean room model and joining all these different data sources and cooperatives. Is the privacy case absolutely rock solid?
Well, I think there's a reason that, you know, privacy evangelists and you know, industry trade bodies and clients are angry. And really that's, you know, the current solutions that have been in market and that are still in market, many of them just risk exposure of customer data by sharing and activating the client's data directly within the ecosystem. And that leads to data leakage, exposure, privacy infractions. That'll just continue to increase as data moves across first, second, third party data sources. And so when you're not ensuring that you have non-movement of data as well as differential privacy techniques to enhance it, you know, you're going to continue to be under siege. And I think that that's a totally, you know, fair argument by the industry. But I would say it's not the end of the world as we know it. And, you know, frankly, I would like the goalposts to be moved in a way that's best for consumers. And so many initiatives and decisions by big companies, by small companies are finally prioritizing consumers and talking about their privacy and the security and protection of their data. And so, frankly, I applaud the privacy campaigners who are truly looking out for better practices and championing more innovative solutions like InfoZone, which raises the standards. I think what troubles me a little bit, or what I start to see, is when the industry is just still not clear on the standards, communication, consistency on timing, because it just makes it incredibly challenging, you know, to what we've talked about before for like some of the smaller businesses. And I also think it's positive that these topics are no longer exclusive to this podcast or to all of us who are in the industry, but frankly, it's being acknowledged as a topic where, you know, politicians actually have to have a stance on this, and you need to really understand the inner workings of the industry. And it's just putting a lot of work on the trade bodies and journalists and, you know, the industry leaders to educate so much on just the way and basics of how internet advertising works and has worked, and what the challenges of that are, and what the solutions are, and alignment on those solutions. So don't envy any of the leaders who are the most under pressure to fight this fight of just, frankly, education on behalf of so many. Our CEO, Brian Lesser, who you know, he actually just did a byline. I think the title of that is sort of like what should be, you know, really the goal. It's how do you create a digital marketplace that protects both privacy and profits? And I think that's going to be a really challenging needle to thread. But I feel like we're really well positioned, and we're already helping clients, frankly, to do exactly that and not make change and innovation and doing right by consumers this really big, scary, challenging thing that hurts your business. It's something that should differentiate and ultimately enhance your business. It should be a competitive advantage, in my opinion.
I agree. I think Apple are interesting in the way they're exploring using privacy as both a selling point to consumers, a weapon against competitors, and I'm sure they're going to build a mighty fine ad business off the back of it. Staying on the subject of the tech giants, there is a school of thought that says all these privacy changes, particularly in terms of when it comes to, you know, the demise of cookies, that is going to benefit this of large tech giants, the walled gardens, who have huge amounts of first party data, of course, multiple ways to access consumers directly, sometimes in the browser. You know, ultimately, do you think that all of this is going to help them win out, or will we see a publisher renaissance and freedom and democracy restored to the people?
Well, unfortunately, I recently saw Amazon's ad business shift from what was in quotes other reported revenue to its own segment. And I also caught Google's earnings as well. And so that's also not for the faint of heart. I don't think that these large tech giants are losing or will lose. And I think privacy changes will drive a new level of accountability, which is great, but it also requires change, and change is obviously where some of the smaller players are much more challenged. I see advertisers being much more savvy to diversify outside of walled gardens. And I think they'll be a huge part of the change to really help publishers. So like utilizing clean room technology to just really stack up their own walled garden or their own network and ecosystem of different audiences that they want to work with. And obviously our technology helps to do that. And so, you know, the question, how do you combat the largest tech giants in terms of reach and scale? Well, you pull together a massive army of your own audiences across partners. And so you create a massive selection that rivals it. So you take number four, number five, number six, number seven. And I think that's one way we see a lot of clients doing that. And I think, you know, brands making thoughtful decisions that are still good for, you know, driving ROI and performance for their brand strategy, I think is incredibly, you know, powerful and persuasive in terms of helping publishers. I also just think it's not going to be about those big three. I mean, I would say don't sleep on Microsoft with acquisitions and successful growth. I'm biased, but some amazing, technology that they'll soon have and just really awesome leadership that we've seen across Microsoft for, you know, the past couple of years. I think we'll see an advertising success story over there, you know, and then don't sleep on some of the other, you know, still labeled as publishers, but audio. I think there's just some other areas that are going to, you know, continue to take a little bit of share, which is, you know, really exciting. Retail, obviously, another one as well.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on Microsoft. It's absolutely fascinating to see. The other thing I would say about Microsoft is that, you know, a lot of their ad products they're just a little bit siloed. You know, I can't see many advertisers want to buy across LinkedIn and Activision, for example. Maybe they'll, you know, sort of keep expanding, keep unifying everything. But I think that's one thing Google has done in a very clever way, is that a lot of their products, there's something for everyone.
Yeah, you may not even know a product you're using is Google. That's how diversified they are.
Yeah, it is. And that's something that they've done extremely, extremely well. There you go. Nice thing about Google. That'll be on the record, anyone from Google listening. So I mean, what's the most interesting area, you know, of the emerging areas for InfoSum? You know, when I say interesting area, I'm talking about, you know, areas of the industry. I'm curious about your feeling on retail media. Are you guys seeing any growth there?
Yeah, I mean, I hate selecting just one area, but you mentioned retail media, and that's a great one, so I'll go with it. I mean, it's just a completely hot area. We just actually, a couple of weeks back in January, we kick off the year always with strategic priorities and some of our planning, research, and analysis. And retail media ad spending, you know, one of the takeaways, it's going to quadruple in 4 years. And so by 2023, marketers will spend more than $52 billion on ads across websites or apps that are mainly e-commerce focused. And so those stats alone are reasons to motivate retailers to innovate and take advantage of this. And, you know, clean room technology is going to be just incredibly essential in order to do it. And so you just see retailers who control this wealth of consumer data that they can use to inform ad targeting. That's extremely valuable to brands. You know, we've talked about that before with some of the brands who don't have access to as much rich first party data. And then the ads served in retail media networks is so fascinating about it, is it expands the entire purchase funnel. So it's awareness, consideration, purchase. And then when you actually break down the business of retail, you know, you often see that, you know, maybe some of the barriers for things like clean room are, okay, I don't want to invest in new technology, or there's a cost to me that I didn't have before. But profit margins for digital advertising are generally much higher than for in-store or online retail. And so I just don't think that sort of barrier of a new cost, a new innovation to adopt. And I don't see that from any of the retail clients that we're both presently working with or will be announcing soon. If anything, I just think they're moving fast, and, you know, they just want to keep, they want the rest of the ecosystem to move fast and, you know, be in these environments as well.
I appreciate, I did ask you a question about what you thought was the most interesting emerging area for InfoSum, and then went, how about retail media? Is there anything else outside of retail media that, you know, that particularly excite you?
I think healthcare. I just think you can't live through a pandemic and just not have it top of mind. And you can't think about, you know, what data needs to be protected more than all others and not think of healthcare. And so I think healthcare, I think that, you know, you and I have talked a lot about obviously marketing and advertising, you know, but when I am talking to family and friends who are less within the world of marketing and advertising, I often always say that the possibilities for data collaboration and unlocking data's limitless potential, you know, extend well beyond just marketing and advertising. You know, there's enterprise use cases we've got clients, you know, utilizing today across different business segments. I think there'll continue to be some really interesting innovations in financial services and healthcare as well that don't necessarily have to be for better data-driven marketing, performance ROI, all the things we talked about, but that can, you know, be for R&D, that can be for a lot of other sort of range of use cases that are just good for business or customer service.
Yeah. I mean, the healthcare industry is obviously, as I'm sure you're aware, is very heavily regulated over here, where they have to be. Europeans are, you know, consistently amazed when they go and turn on a TV in their hotel room in New York or wherever, and they're just amazed to see all these ads being pumped at them with the, you know, the warning at the end of, you know, this may cause you to commit suicide or
and you may die in fine print.
So but yeah, I can see how, particularly when it comes to insights and understanding people and the way they're responding to certain things, you can learn a huge amount. We had I've blanked on her name now, sorry, I'm gonna have to edit this out now. Shit. Fuck, I know her really well as well. Oh, okay. I'll just come back to it now. Hopefully, I don't leave this bit in. we had Charlie Johnson from Digital Element presented a recent event actually about how they were using location data for things like how people were congregating during the pandemic for things like spring break and sort of seeing the clusters of people and then the, you know, the authorities were able to use the COVID, match the COVID rates and the spread of the virus to their location data. So I think there is all these, like, there are all these wonderful uses for the technologies that we use, you know, to be a force for good in the world. Not just selling people the solution, but helping provide those solutions. So final question. So if you had 10 million to invest in a particular company or a particular sector tomorrow, and you're not allowed to invest in InfoZone, where would you invest it and why?
I love this question. I think probably, so a little bit of context here. So I recently took over InfoZone's human resources function, which day one of doing so, I proudly renamed it our people function. So the people function. And in pretty much every week, I just see huge opportunities for technology, just given the new way of working. So I think the sector we might call future of work, or really just like people management software. And that's really like, how can technology adapt and kind of address the challenges that we've all endured through the pandemic with adjusted policies and with adjusted ways of working and new tools, and just the support that's necessary. So I think that would probably be one sector that I just think is going to grow and is just so hugely helpful no matter what business you're in. The other, I would say mental health. At InfoZone, we champion mental health awareness. We try to remove the stigma when you're just talking about it. We work to provide resources. And so that's another area where on a regular basis, I'm just looking at like, what more can we do? What more can we give employees? You know, what sort of benefits can exist that just really help? And again, I think that's hopefully commonplace in a lot of companies, just given the pandemic and the new way of working. But I see kind of mental health, you know, not just advocacy, but tools and technology platforms and access to that, you know, kind of an exploding area where, you know, week over week, there's something new in my inbox of like, you know, try this out, test this. And And that's definitely one of the ones where I respond, because I just think it's so important to, you know, find, you know, options that kind of work for, you know, across our different regions for InfoSum, since we're a global company, but then also just for, you know, the different challenges that people are facing given the pandemic.
Yeah, that's a fascinating answer. It's something that I think a lot of, I think both of those issues, I mean, the working from home and the mental health, they kind of go hand in hand as well, where a friend of mine was, I won't name the company, but it was a large technology company that has a huge remote support base spread across Ireland. So you'd have a lot of people in, you know, the Irish countryside sort of providing tech support for this company. And they were been doing this for years, but they just struggle so much with mental health, where people were just weren't coping being in the house on their own, you know, often remote locations. Even people with who were living with other people, but maybe were just spending the majority of their week and were unable to cope as a result, and nobody to lean on when it comes to work stress or anything like that. So that they've sort of had to put all sorts of support measures in place. I think they're, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we start to see a bit of a mental health epidemic. I mean, there is no one size fits all. There's somebody listening to this thinking like, I'm fine, I love working from home and I'm fine. I know there's no one size fits all. Other people are absolutely fine. I'm one of the people who would probably collapse, you know. I really don't like working from home all the time at all. I mean, I'm working from home today quite happily, but it's really not for me, and I know it would send me down quite a miserable path very quickly. So I think you've struck on something there. I think there is going to be a huge market in helping everyone adapt to the new world. I think it's a very interesting space. So, well, thank you very much for taking the time. That was a fantastic chat.
Yeah, thank you. I love talking about clean rooms and wearing my hazmat suit.
Sorry. That was great. We'll have to have you back sometime, Lauren. Cheers.
Awesome. Thank you so much.